Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the don't nearly view system deal. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
Jones! Bowden!
He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. I'm trying to sound positive. I'm feeling a bit tired, actually, because I've actually had a bowl today. And it just reminds me how hard bowling is, especially when you're in your later years. I won't dwell on it, but just to say, I have actually got quite a bad bruise on my left hand, which, Simon, you can probably see here because we're on Zoom. And that's from an attempted catch. And it leads into our guest today, who, of course, is Paul Collingwood, who was in our virtual cricket club last week. And we're focusing quite a bit on fielding in today's show. And, well, I need some help from Collie because that damage to my left hand is indicative of not taking a catch very well. I did stop it from going before.
Where were you?
At least. I was, well, it was a caught and bowled attempt, actually.
You stopped it from going a caught and bowled attempt, and you stopped it from
going. So I'm saved. I saved it a few runs off my own bowling. I was protecting my analysis. You see,
what was your analysis?
Oh,
you better
tell us. It was 1 for 22, and the sad part about it is, you know how a fast bowler always talks about his objective. That, you know, the Pat Cumminses and Glenn McGraths and Jimmy Andersons of this world talk about hitting the top of off stump, or my delivery that took the wicket hit near the bottom of the off stump. So at least the line was good, but the pace was so poor that it was going down on the way to hitting the stump and very low down. Yeah. So
just dribbled onto the wicket.
Barely had enough pace to take the bails off.
Sometimes nature tells you things, Yoz. I don't know what conclusions you want to draw from your bowling today,
but sometimes nature
tells us something. Yeah. Anyway, you mentioned Jimmy Anderson there. Jimmy Anderson playing in the latest round of championship matches. In a way, it's sort of been the most frustrating cricket week for a while, hasn't it? The IPL has been suspended, postponed, and the rain intervened in the championship for the first time, not least in that match that Jimmy Anderson played in. But still remarkable figures for Anderson, really. I mean, you know, talk about longevity and your longevity. You know, he's still going, of course. What is he, 39 this summer? 24 overs, 10 maidens, 3 for 40. I mean, he's such a miserly bowler. And he's also closing in on a significant landmark as well.
Mm, yes, he's got 992 first-class wickets. So in the next couple of games for Lancashire, he could not only get to 1,000, but actually he could be the last person to take 1,000 wickets, because it's something. I mean, you know, the top players now are protected by central contracts, and obviously the best players only play really for their international side and not that much for their county or their domestic team. And so therefore, it's going to be hard to mount up that number of wickets in first-class cricket for anyone in future. I think the nearest or the most likely could be Simon Harmer, who is still in his early 30s and has 660-odd wickets. And so he could get there, but you have to play another 5 or 6 years of both English county cricket and also domestic cricket in South Africa. But, of course, being a spinner, he's probably got a bit more chance. I definitely think Jimmy's got to be the last fast bowler to get to 1,000. I just don't see how anyone else. I mean, Stuart Broad's on about 800, 820 or something like that. But, you know, that's considering he only plays the odd game for Notts and then the international summer, him getting another 180 wickets, is that possible?
It's possible, but probably not necessarily that likely. I mean, you never quite know what's
going to happen. Listen, he's getting married to Molly King, isn't he? So I reckon that could dent his enthusiasm for being a fast bowler for a lot longer. Because she does the early morning show on Radio 1 often, so they have to get up about 4 in the morning. You know he lives round the corner from you. He's almost your neighbour, actually. You might even see him walking his dog or something. From time to time,
I could hit a six into his garden. Just to remind me, how many wickets did you take in your first class career?
Just under 500.
Right. Okay. Because Grav was in the Virtual Cricket Club, wasn't he, last week? And we had Collie with us. David Graveney was in the Virtual Cricket Club last week, and he got quite close to 1,000.
Yeah, he did.
But he didn't quite manage it. And I suppose it's a really significant landmark. It's the 100-100s, isn't it? It's the bowler's equivalent of 100-100s, and it might well be that no more players will make 100-100s. It's the same thing, 1,000 wickets, 100-100s, because there's less first class cricket played now. That's one thing, and also there is that sort of nagging feeling about the future of the county championship. That suggestion at the start of the season, that sort of concern that in 10 years' time, there might not be 18 first class counties, so there might be many fewer matches. Who knows? I mean, that is pure speculation. But there is less first class cricket, and you're right that the top class players, I suppose, are playing less of it. And the last person to make 100-100s was Mark Ramprakash. And that's sort of player. And also, the other thing about Ramps as well was his longevity, wasn't it? His sort of thirst for runs. He kept on going, played for a very long time. So you've got to have A, class, and B, significant longevity.
And I suppose start young as well, get a lot of hundreds earlier, because Ramps was in the Middlesex side at 17, and I think he made his first 100 at 18. You need a kind of a good head start as a youngster to get 100-100s, and probably the same for 1,000 wickets. I mean, Jimmy, of course, was in the Lancashire side when he was in his early 20s, I think 20 probably when he made his debut. 19 years of bowling fast. I mean, it's remarkable. Bowling, fast bowling is so hard. I just trundle up and bowl probably about 50 miles an hour, but even that hurts. And it's just...
You are 20 years older than me.
Yeah, I mean, that is true, but it always hurt. And actually, I remember the day after I'd retired when I just lay down on the grass covering a match as a journalist. I lay down on the grass at Canterbury and stared up at the blue sky, and I just thought to myself, wow, I haven't got a bowl today. It is so painful. I mean, he's so lucky, Jimmy, that he's such a wonderful athlete. He's so light on his feet. He's so nimble. He's so flexible. Obviously, he works at it to maintain that. And no doubt, his diet is extremely good as well. And people are much more sort of educated about how to maintain your fitness now. And I mean, look at someone like Mo Farah. He's been breaking records in his mid-30s. Probably 10, 15 years ago, wouldn't have been able to sustain his running career like that. It's partly technology and knowledge and awareness, but still, you have to say it's extraordinary from Jimmy.
Now, we've been talking for 7.5 minutes, Yoz, and we haven't mentioned a particular match place over the weekend at Lords. It was something you flagged up last week in the podcast.
Aren't you going to put your best Bristolian accent on for this little section?
Middlesex and Gloucestershire at Lords, Yozzer, and it was an emphatic victory for the men from the West Country. And they did it in 3 days, and they seem unstoppable at the moment. I mean, you look down that side, you look down the Gloucestershire side, and it's certainly not a team with any stars in. They got Craig Brathwaite, West Indies captain. Very very solid opener. He's done okay so far. Nothing particularly flashy or spectacular, actually. There's James Bracey, who may well make his England debut this summer, promising young player. But those are, I suppose, their standout players. Ian Cockburn has done well in the last couple of weeks. A brilliant match-winning 100 last Sunday against Leicestershire, and also really important innings in Gloucestershire's first innings, where he made a quick half century, which gave them some momentum and helped them to a 67-run first innings lead. I saw one newspaper this morning, I think it was the Sunday Times, saying, when is it time to take Gloucestershire seriously as potential county champions? Well, they've never done it in what's considered to be the modern championship from 1890 onwards. I mean, I honestly still don't see them as potential champions. I really don't. I don't think they're strong enough all round. And if they lose Bracey or whatever, but what they do have is they have a great team spirit, and they have a plan. Their bowling attack works together, and they've really exploited that. Although, having said that, they went 400 against Hampshire, they went 400 against Leicestershire, and they would have come back and win against Leicestershire, and they won 4 out of 5, and they've got more points than any other county in the county championship. Meanwhile, poor old Middlesex, Yoles, they just look a bit thin to me. I know, Toby Rowland Jones was ruled out of this match, wasn't he?
He's ruled out for a while, isn't he?
Yeah, it was very sad for him, and Finney didn't play in this game either. But the team looks just a bit thin to me. You think of those teams that you played in. I mean, the idea of a Gloucestershire side going to Lords and winning in your era, never looked very likely.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. And it was funny, but I played against Gloucestershire a lot. And we had David Graveney on, didn't we? Well, we had him on the last podcast. And I must admit, I love Grav. He was a lovely bloke to play with, but he was even better to play against. Because I just felt that Gloucestershire side almost sometimes apologised for being on the field. We won't keep you long, kind of thing. And it was probably the Middlesex cockiness that made them like that. But it was they were a bit too polite almost. And so we just sort of steamrolled them mostly. Obviously, Gloucester came back with a vengeance with Sid Lawrence and Courtney Walsh opening the bowling. Although, even then, I think we tended to beat you because we just had more depth, and there was just something about, well, okay, so you might be Sid Lawrence and Courtney Walsh, but we'll take you on. We've got X number of fine batsmen and even more bowlers. So, yeah, it is interesting, and I'm very... it's sad that Gloucester have never won it. The home of W.G. Grace, and Gloucestershire actually did win the championship in the 1870s before it was a sort of really official tournament in the 1890s. So I really hope they can do it. I feel a bit like you that there just isn't quite enough quality there to sustain it. But that's one thing. Middlesex, I worry about Middlesex. I just look at them and I just think they look young and a bit naive. And I know, Tim Murta's obviously not young, and John Simpson's not young, and Sam Robson's not young. And, there's two or three very good cricketers there, but I don't know who their match winners are, apart from maybe Tim Murta, who, is an absolute master of bowling at Lords in particular. But who else is going to win matches? Nick Gubbins is a very talented player, but hasn't ever quite really asserted himself. And then there's other young bowlers and batsmen who are, quite talented and obviously enthusiastic. But to me, they don't look like the hard-bitten pros that we had 20 years ago. And they just don't look a threat, really. And I don't know who their leaders are, and I don't know who their really strong characters are. And you need people to, you need your Simon Harmer, someone like that who's... I mean, have you ever shaken Simon Harmer's hand? He almost crushes your hand. Yeah. And Mike Gatting was like that as well. When you meet people, like, they really squeeze your hand, and his Simon Harmer's hands are enormous. They're like dustbin lids almost. And they've got presence, players like that. Middlesex don't seem to have many of those.
Well, they've lost 4 out of their 5 matches so far. And you look at that group that they're in, and Gloucestershire have won 4 and Somerset have won 4. And those Gloucestershire's next matches against Somerset, well, they have a rest in the next round of matches. You actually say at the moment, I mean, they've got more points than anyone else. And they look a pretty good bet for qualifying for the first division that's going to go on in September. And then if you win that, then you win the county championship. And if you're in the top two, you go on and play the Bob Willis Trophy final at Lords. I mean, they'll have to play poorly from here not to make the reformed first division later in the season. So that gives them a chance, puts them in the the top six. But have they got enough all-round strength? Well, we'll have to wait and see. But, I mean, they've had a remarkable start to the season. I think they took quite a lot of confidence from that match against Hampshire where they were outplayed, but they managed to block it out for a draw. A bit like Jimmy and Monty in Cardiff. You know, the England were outplayed in that test match down in Cardiff, but they took a lot of confidence from that and they were able to turn the Ashes around and win the series. They won at Lords and then they won at the Oval. So we'll see. I mean, you still think that Somerset are, you know, pretty strong. Essex at the moment, the county champions, languishing in fifth place in their group. It's an altogether tighter group though, that one. Nottinghamshire, Warwickshire, Worcester, Durham, Essex, Derbyshire. Mm. You know, you wouldn't necessarily rule Essex out, although they've got a bit of you know, ground to make up. Mm. But there'll be more draws in that group. Mm. In Group 1. Group 2, lots of results. And Lancashire and Yorkshire dominating in the third group as well, though Northants have come back well with a couple of victories, which is, you know, just good. It's good for the game. You know, I think that's what we got from Scott Borthwick, didn't we, at the start of the season when we spoke to him on the podcast. And he said that feeling that we're all in it to win the, you know, we can all win the championship. That sort of two division system, it perhaps deflated some players and some teams, but not quite this season. Although, you know, it is still Lancashire, Yorkshire, Somerset, Nottinghamshire, Warwickshire. You know, that they are the leading teams at the moment, the test playing grounds, and Gloucestershire, who are obviously an international ground as well. They are up there as well with, as I said, more points than anyone else, 95 points so far in this season. But it rained for the first time, which put a dampener on it. And also, Yoz, this week, the IPL was suspended. We should say something about that. I mean, I read the other day that if it's not played on, you know, they don't find a window for it to resume sometime or other, then they'll lose $340 million, which is, you know, that's a huge amount of money to go out of the game. It's not easy. It's not going to be easy to fit it in. No. And it's going to be a huge logistical problem. It's all very well, you know, having a competition somewhere, but you've got to get all the players in and all the protocols involved in that.
Mm. Yeah, it's very difficult. I'll probably get more immediate information on that in a couple of days when I'm having a meeting with Manoj Badali, the owner of the Royals, about something, and he's been really busy trying to figure out what they're going to do next. So, you know, we'll probably get some more steering on that shortly. I mean, yeah, it's obviously it's the broadcast rights, the media rights that primarily are the thing that costs the money if you don't play the tournament. And the IPL represents a third of the global income of cricket, round about $600 million in total, $600 million. So, you know, it will be felt that loss will be felt by everybody, by obviously players, coaches. You know, they'll get some of their money from this truncated season, but not all of it. And if you're like me and you spend the money before you've got it, you're going to be in trouble. So, you know, it is something that will be really taxing everybody. There was obviously stories about them finishing it in England in September, though I think
that seems to have been ruled out, doesn't it?
So it's a yeah. What is always remarkable is they do come up with a solution, and the thing they can't do, I think, is wait till next year to complete it. Because
why is that?
Because they've already delayed the there's an auction every there's a grand auction every 3 years in the IPL that where all the players pretty much are jumbled up. And then over that three-year term, you can let a few players go and buy a few players up, but they're not all thrown in the hat, whereas every 3 years they are. And it's one of the kind of fundamental principles of the IPL to make sure that a lot of the best players are shared out to different teams so that you don't just get a dominant side retaining all their players. You want to try and get as much level playing field, unpredictable outcomes as you can. So they have this auction every 3 years, and they've already postponed that to get this IPL in, to get the delayed one in September in, and then they felt because it's such a short time between the delayed one in September and this one now, they couldn't do the grand auction, so they've got to do the grand auction in December this year, and also new teams are coming on board as well, so you can't see any window for playing the tournament or, you know, completing the tournament after sort of October, November, really, because they've got to get on with the new auction and everything for the new setup with more teams in April next year.
Yeah, it's a really challenging situation. Well, it's been, as everyone knows, it's been a hugely challenging year. Also, you know, getting cricket back on, getting sport back on. England, we've got that test series coming up against New Zealand in June. You know, we hope there might be spectators at the ground. You know, who knows what the situation is going to look like when, you know, the white ball matches start. Sri Lanka and Pakistan are here. And then, of course, India coming later in the summer. Well, they're coming first, the World Test Championship final, then they're coming later in the summer for their test series. They named their squad this week. I didn't see that many surprises, if any, actually, in their squad. No Hardik Pandya, though, just caught my eye, because I suppose he's the one player that could sort of balance them up a bit, but his bowling probably is a bit of a weak suit now. And if, you know, if he was the first seamer, first change seamer, they played two spinners, then England probably wouldn't mind that too much. But I mean, from this distance, it looks to me as it's going to be hard for them to play both Ashwin and Jadeja in their test match side in English conditions.
They don't tend to, though, do they? And Ashwin hasn't got a great record in England. So I can see them playing Jadeja only, which is an extraordinary sort of luxurious position to be in, to leave out someone like Ravi Ashwin. But he hasn't ever kind of quite cracked England, has he? And even when he's come and played in county cricket, you know, for teams like Worcestershire, he hasn't really set the world alight. So I don't know whether he finds the pitch is a bit too dead or something, but he hasn't quite cracked it. Whereas Jadeja, just such a live wire who can fire them in and tease batsmen, spins it away from the right-hander, obviously has a value with the bat and in the field as well. So, you know, they tend to sort of favour him first. Actually, I saw today, of course, the first time we'll see the Indian team is in that World Test Championship final at the Aegeus Bowl. And actually, at the match I played in today, we were honoured by the presence of Rod Bransgrove, who is, of course, the chairman of Hampshire and basically has bankrolled the Aegeus Bowl for about the last 10 years or even more, 20 years. Lovely man, such a dedicated sort of servant to the game, really, and benefactor. He said he still hasn't got the contract to agree this World Test Championship final. He hasn't got it officially, but he's assuming it's happening. And so do we all.
Well, I think India and New Zealand are assuming it's going to happen.
They've got the hotel. Lovely man, actually. I do. He does have a rather lovely life now. And he's got this. Every year when England play in the West Indies, he parks his yacht off Bridgetown, invites a few players to come and visit for the night. It's a way to watch a test match in the Caribbean, isn't it?
I suppose so, yeah. Just going back to India, just one thought. I mean, they could play Jadeja and Ashwin, and then they would play three seamers because they've got Pant to bat at six. So, that could be one way of going, I suppose.
I think that's a bit of a risk. I think that's a risk in England, but having Pant at six. He probably will bat at six, but I don't know. You can easily lose four quick wickets, can't you, to the Duke's new ball? And, you know, if we're going to do the tit for tat and leave a bit of grass on to compensate for Ahmedabad and Chennai in the winter, it's a bit risky having, you know, your tail, if you like, starting at seven. You lose 4 for 20.
Well,
I mean, struggling.
I wouldn't necessarily say Jadeja is a tail if starting at seven.
So he's not. But I just think I'd rather have Jadeja at eight. I think.
Yeah.
In England. And then three.
Well, we'll see. It feels as though we're in a sort of in the phony war at the moment. It's May. I mean, it's always a great month, May. It's one of my favourite months of the year, really. You know, that sense of anticipation, the nights drawing out, the weather improving, probably the war. Well.
Weather improving. I mean, I've just got wetter on a cricket field today than I think ever. We were a bit unlucky. We're on the sort of Hampshire borders near Winchester, and it was beautiful sort of setting, idyllic. The village of Dunna, just off the M3, gorgeous. And it's quite a nice story, actually. The man who owns the land around there is somebody I know called Sir Crispin Davis. And about 10 years ago, he discovered the field at the back of his house in the village was actually a former cricket pitch where Dunner Cricket Club used to play. And he found that you could just see the hint of the old square underneath the stubble or whatever it was in the field. And they decided to resurrect it. So he basically paid to have this ground restored. And it now is a classic village ground on bit of on the side of a sort of windswept hill, but a beautiful idyllic rural setting, which is lovely, unless you're kind of at long leg in just a shirt and it's raining for half an hour and you've still got to finish the game.
Well, you were spoilt when you played the Olds, because as soon as it rained, you all trooped off the field. All the club cricketers listening to this will know. They'll have had matches.
No, I think you should play on. I think you should play on, actually. I agree with you. I mean, you've often said, isn't it, it's sort of totally ironic that cricket was invented in England, because it's kind of got often the most unsuitable weather.
It's bizarre. It's bizarre the game was, you know, thought of here. When you think of all the countries that we go to, that their weather's, largely speaking, fantastic, isn't it? You know, South Africa, Sri Lanka, India, West Indies. I mean, of course, it does rain. It needs to rain. But, you know, the cricket playing weather there is Australia, you know, it's generally brilliant. Bangladesh, I suppose the only one is in New Zealand, which is a bit like England. Although every time I go, been there, the weather's been absolutely fantastic. Anyway, so you've got a bit of sort of club cricketers sort of medicine today, Yoz.
Yeah, and I really admire it that they get the game done, and we had a tea as well. So it was good old traditional fare down in Dunner today, and well done to them for putting that on, and well done to Crispin for restoring that ground as well. It's a sort of throwback, really. It feels like the 19th century.
Okay then, Yoz, how much did you enjoy fielding? Was that your least favourite aspect of playing cricket?
Well, I didn't enjoy it today, that's for sure, when it was raining and I was chasing around a long leg boundary with about 4 inches of stubble to run over. Actually, to be honest, I did enjoy fielding. I might be a rare ex-bowler who says that, but I thought it was a good opportunity to show off. And I spent a lot of my youth on a beach in Kent, Hythe, in fact, which was a stony beach. And I loved it because I just spent hours picking up stones and hurling them into the sea. And also my favourite game was finding an old Coke tin and putting stone little pebbles in it and positioning it, balancing it on a breakwater, and then seeing how many stones I needed to throw at it before it fell off. So just aiming at it. So I love the opportunity, fielding-wise, to chase around the boundary, pick up a ball and hurl it over the stumps. And that, to me, was really exciting. And it was a bit of showing off, actually. And, yeah, and I think also fielding is something that you're part of the team effort doing, and you can contribute by not just... You know, there are many fielders who will just stand on the boundary and, you know, sign autographs or something in between balls or great gaze into space. I think even if you're on the boundary, you can have an influence by just being good at anticipating certain shots, by just shifting your position very slightly to different batsmen. I used to love fielding at deep square leg to somebody like John Embry, the spinner, because I knew some batsmen liked a sort of slog sweep, and some batsmen liked a little paddle sweep, fine sweep, and some batsmen didn't sweep at all. So I sort of adjusted my position slightly, sometimes to the incurring the wrath of Embry, who liked everybody to be in exactly the position that they were put in. But I found it intriguing to just adjust my position slightly to different batsmen to try and counter the type of shots they play. So I think it's not just the physical part of it that you can really enjoy, but it's the strategic part of it as well.
I suppose in your time, how many sort of times would you have been in the field for 2 days, though? Because you probably played quite a lot of three-day cricket. You'd play some four-day cricket, wouldn't you? You'd play a lot of three-day cricket. And so, you know, there were often, there'd been time limits on the first innings, for example, 100 overs. But I mean, these days, there was that match earlier in the season, which we talked about, where Hampshire were in the field because they enforced a follow-on for 229 overs. I mean, that is a heck of a long time to be out in the field. And four-day cricket, I think you'd like to be in the field for longer because teams bat for longer. So, what was the longest you were ever in the field, though? Can you remember?
Well, actually, I had one horrendous experience in India. Playing in a five-day game there. It was the Bengal Cricket Association's 50th anniversary, and I played in a sort of England-World 11 team against India in a five-day game. We lost the toss and were in the field for 2 days. They then batted a bit in on the third day and made about 500 or 600. Then eventually they declared, and we went into bat and were bowled out in two sessions. So we're back in the field again on the third night, having fielded for two and a bit days already. So that was the longest, and that would have been 270 overs minus sort of the 60 or 50 that we batted. So about 220 overs with just a little gap for a bit of batting. Yeah, and it was really exhausting. But that was in Calcutta, in very high temperatures as well.
Yeah, well, so, you've got to sort of learn to love it, really, haven't you? Because you're going to do more fielding than anything else. Mm. And we're talking about fielding because we had Paul Collingwood in the cricket club, the virtual cricket club, last week. And I think it's fair to say he was one of England's best ever fielders. I think there's much doubt about that. I mean, we all can think of that one really famous incident, that great catch he took to dismiss Matthew Hayden in that 2005 One Day International at Bristol, where Kevin Peterson won the match with the bat, that one-handed catch at backward point. Well, we asked him about that catch, actually. He said it wasn't the best catch he took during his career.
The weird thing is, it's like spectacular goals. A lot of it's made by the camera angle and how good the footage is. There was one in the West Indies, it was Brian Lara's last game. And I think it was Devon Smith, a left-handed batsman, hit the ball out to backward point. And actually, I didn't think I was ever going to get to that one. I kind of obviously dived and stretched for it and thankfully went into the fingertips. So I think that was probably my best catch, but nobody ever remembers it. And everyone always remembers catches against Australia and especially Matthew Hayden, so everyone dubbed that as my best catch. So I'll take it. I mean, they were obviously pretty good catches, and but I just love fielding. Right from an early age, I just loved catching balls and diving around and being at school and getting holes in your trousers because you're in the playground diving around trying to stop balls and stuff like that. It's I just love fielding. So the players, when I'm coaching England, they say, "Do you miss it? What do you miss?" And I say, "I actually miss fielding." And they look at me like, "What? Fielding? You miss?" I go, "Yeah, no, I do, because I was always feeling anxious about me batting or me bowling, because you're never quite sure how it would go. But fielding, I knew I was pretty good, so I was, I just loved it."
What are your top three tips to you? Two fielders, basically. What would you say to them? To current players and also, I suppose, to youngsters as well, listening to this.
Well, I would say, first of all, agility. So getting yourself fit enough to be able to move in the field is one thing. Anticipation. And I think if you watch the best fielders in the world, they seem to be a couple of yards ahead of the rest. And that comes from understanding what shots the batsman's going to play, what length the ball is. So there's things that you can pick up even before the batsman's hit the ball. Just find ways to enjoy it, because you're in the field a fair bit. So actually just come up with ways or training drills and when you're practicing or things in the field that you can actually enjoy and just be aggressive, be attacking when it comes to the field.
You mentioned about being athletic. I mean, how do you, without obviously playing sport, should you do yoga or particular stretches, or how do you become more athletic without just playing loads of cricket?
Well, I'm a big believer that you play as many sports as you can. So I think if you, squash, tennis, the movement that you have to have, the pace that you've got to get to the ball quickly, different directions. Football, you know, the pace of being able to turn quickly, or these are all the kind of attributes that you need when you are in the field. And you've got to be able to dive. I mean, all the fast bowlers now have got to be able to dive. So getting used to actually hitting the floor. And the reason why a lot of people don't dive because they're scared of injuring themselves when they're actually hitting the floor. So there's plenty of sports where you can play rugby and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd just be as active as you possibly can. And hopefully that will transfer into some good fielding positions.
Is the way fielding coaching taught now, coached, different from when you first started? I mean, is there been a sort of huge sort of upward curve, really, in the emphasis, I suppose, and in the things that coaches say to fielders?
Well, yeah, 100%. I mean, we've all realised, certainly over the past, I mean, I started in 2001 with England, and I wouldn't say the intensity of our fielding was very good. And you look at footage, I mean, it's quite laughable, really, when you look back at how some people used to field. The difference now is everyone is expected to, as I said before, is intensively be 100%, be able to dive in the field, catching catches on the boundary and understanding where the rope is. It's really putting your body on the line. The problem is with fielding is there's no real measurements from cricket. You know, you've got your batting averages, you've got your strike rates, you've got bowling averages, your strike rates in bowling, all that. But fielding is literally, there's nothing really there. Nobody's come up with a measurement that, wow, look at that, he's the best in the world. It's all just opinion.
Chris Taylor had an app he developed, didn't he?
Yeah, I think a few people have tried it. I mean, Carl Hopkinson, he's the England fielding coach, and he's got an app that, as long as he's the person who's doing it, so it's consistent, you can come up with measurements for the players that you're doing. But again, that all comes down to opinion. Has he just stopped a great stop there? Has he saved two runs? Should he have done better? Would someone else have saved more? It all comes down to opinion. That's the beauty about fielding, is actually you're doing it solely for the team. I think it's a great gauge of actually how close the team is together when you see a good fielding side and they're putting the effort in together. But fielding drills now, the intensity of them are exceptional. You know, I think allowing the players to experiment a lot more as well, you know, allowing them to do one-handed stuff. So catching with one hand, picking up with the left hand and then throwing with the right. Just developing the hand-eye coordination, not just in the strong hand, but in both hands.
What's been the best, in batting we've had, you know, the dog stick, which has obviously helped coaches massively. What's been the biggest add-on to fielding coaching? What kind of tool or bit of kit is the most useful?
I like the Incrediballs.
Because you can hit them really hard, can't you?
Hit Incrediballs really hard.
Yeah.
You're not going to bruise your fingers too much. So you can get that real intensity and the real pace into the ball that you're going to get in the match without damaging the players too much. We use bowling machines as well. Obviously, take the legs off them and have them down low. We use those to do slip catching. So having the bat right next to the bowling machine and you know, deflecting the ball out of there.
You good with that?
I think so. I'm trying to develop nicking left-handed as well, which is the next level. But yeah, I like to use a stump for nicking for spinners, because I think that obviously the roundness of the stump, it's unpredictable and it really does clip off. So that's something that we've developed. Stokesy really enjoys using the stump. I always think if you replicate what you're going to get in the match, then the player will find a way and understand what level he needs to get to. To me, it's all about how do you give that player exactly what they're going to get in the match in terms of the pace and the intensity. Duncan Fletcher was always one, actually, when we first started. If we did a fielding drill and we did it kind of 60-70%, he was always like, no, you've got to do it at 100% because your foot patterns are totally different when you're going at 100%. So he was always he was big into his fielding when I first started.
Carl Hopkinson's sort of evaluation of fielding, Collie. So is it as simple as, you know, you come off the field after a day in the dirt and there's a sheet and he says, right, you're minus eight, you're plus two or plus 10. Is it much more sophisticated than that? Is there that measurement there, or how does it work?
Well, yeah, I mean, he'll have, if you drop a catch, for example, it'll be minus five, or if you miss fields, it'll just be the runs added. All he's looking for really is patterns. If there's an area where a fielder is consistently coming unstuck, then we can go away and improve them in that area. So that's why he does the measurements for it. So we can, he records all the slip catching. Where do they catch them? Where do they drop them? Is it low right? Is it low left? Is it with the heads? All that kind of stuff. So really it's just a tool. I mean, he does it on his iPad to give us information about where do we need to develop the players. And it's worked well. You know, we've come up with stuff that we didn't probably come up with before. That's highlighted from what he does. But it takes many hours of recording every single ball, obviously, of the game. I prefer the old school way and just watch the game and and see where, or have a feel of where a player is.
So you're not a notebook person who draws a diagram. Actually, I should get my I'm going to get my field shield out. This is the thing, you were away, so you never saw this, but I got this on Channel 4.
I was back home for the first
were you?
Two test matches, so if you've seen you bring this out, I was laughing at the screen. Yeah.
Well, I bet you were, yeah. But I mean, I'm gonna ask you, what if say we're gonna do a T20 field here? What would you say?
You've not rehearsed at all.
I haven't rehearsed this at all. You're right. What would you say is the sort of most valuable position in T20, or the most kind of, where do you put your best fielder? Would you say for say an opening bowler, a seamer? A Chris Wokes, say.
In one day cricket, backward point is still your most valuable.
Yeah, basically.
I'm going to say during the accumulation period. But the game's changed that much now that backward point was always the place where you would try to stop them just from dropping and running and accumulate. Now, the game of cricket, everyone is really trying to hit the ball a lot harder. So it's almost kind of your extra cover, your mid-off, your mid-on. We give Ben Stokes and Chris Jordan the kind of the license to get themselves in number one and number two positions. So they get the feel when they're out on the park, right? We've got this bowler on, we've got this batsman. Okay, this is going to be the most important position. Generally, as the game goes on, you want to be out on the boundary at deep mid-wickets or mid-on, mid-wickets. Because they can have the most impact on the game and taking spectacular catches on the boundary. You actually don't touch the ball a hell of a lot at backward point, believe it or not. There's a lot more kind of work, the workload of mid-on, mid-off and deep mid-wicket is quite a lot. So get your best fielders in those positions.
Paul Collingwood, I love listening to him. He's just such an enthusiast, isn't he? And of course he won... We should mention this. He won our Virtual Cricket Club quiz, didn't he? 10 out of 10. I mean, he just got all the questions right. And he started out by saying, I'm going to get about 2 out of 10. He got 10 out of 10. Nobody's got 10 out of 10. Not Boycott, Cook, Gooch, Gower. Gower did pretty well. Strauss got 9. We've had loads of people on. You can watch all these quizzes, by the way, on YouTube, on the Analyst YouTube channel. And... The Collingwood's performance was absolutely outstanding. And by the way, we've also got Alan Lamb in the Virtual Cricket Club to see if he can get 10 out of 10. It's actually on Tuesday this week because it's the only day he can do. He's off fishing in Scotland on Wednesday. So he's coming to join us on Tuesday night at 7:30 p.m. You can join us by going to worldsbestcricketclub.com, and it's in aid of the Professional Cricketers Trust, so please join us because we've got a really good community going there, worldsbestcricketclub.com. What I thought was interesting about Collie, though, about his talk about the fielding, was the fact that there is still no totally foolproof way of evaluating a fielding position or a fielding team's performance. I mean, a couple of years ago, we had Chris Taylor on this show, didn't we? Who is the fielding coach from Gloucester originally and was the England fielding coach for a long time. And he developed an app which allowed you to input certain evaluations of a fielder's performance, and then it allowed you to add up the performance of the fielder and the team over a whole fielding session and give them a score. But as Colley says, even that is a bit subjective. So, you know, when a person does a diving stop and it still goes for one, should he have got there quicker and stopped any runs? You know, if there's a brilliant effort at a catch and he saves two runs, like my attempt today, you know, is it a good effort and therefore it saved runs, or is it a bad effort because he wasn't quick enough to get across and he should have taken the catch? So there is an element of subjectivity to these sort of fielding, to this fielding data, which does make it a very hard thing to standardise, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I thought actually the most interesting aspect was patterns, wasn't it? So, for example, if you're noting down every single drop catch or whatever, and you see a pattern there, you know, someone's weak low to his right or her right, then you know, that is an area which you can then work on in your fielding drills. So it's those sorts of things, probably, isn't it? You're right. These things are quite subjective, and you know what's a when a ball struck to you in the covers, say, what might be a relatively straightforward piece of fielding for one fielder might be a brilliant piece of fielding for another, because you're talking about someone who's 37 compared to someone who's 22 or whatever. So you know there is that inevitable subjectivity, but I definitely think you can use it for working on patterns of errors. I think that is probably, as you said, that's probably the most useful aspect. But you know, also as well, you were saying, you know, play as many different sports as possible to sort of get your sort of general athleticism up to a decent level. I noticed you sort of tried to take him down the line of, you know, yoga or Pilates or all those sort of stretchy sort of exercises. But he was sort of talking about, you know, playing as much sport as possible, squash and badminton. Mm. I think Alistair Cook played a lot of badminton, didn't he? I remember him talking about that. I think, did he play Gucci in a lot of badminton?
And that is a really good sport, badminton, isn't it? Because you have to be quite nimble and quick. And it requires you to get very far forward to sort of get the drop shots and reach right over your head high to get the smashes. And also to try and... Actually, you know the Collingwood catch where he puts his right arm over his left shoulder to take the catch? Well, that's another sort of badminton position, isn't it? Because you can smash with your right arm over your left shoulder and kind of smash it back over the net. So badminton's good. I mean, I remember Collie saying also rugby. Rugby's a great sport for fielding because it gets your legs really strong. And he always used to use Johnny Bairstow as the example for someone who played a lot of rugby and has a very strong core and very strong legs to be able to get low to the ground. And actually all that stuff about diving properly as well, being able to dive. Going back to the question you started right at the beginning where you said, did I used to enjoy fielding? I used to love diving. But I don't know, I never hurt myself. And it was a showing off thing. You could make it look spectacular, provided you stop the ball. But you need to be able to do it the right way. And some people come a cropper.
Just on, do you think people, in your experience, would say not be selected because their fielding was poor? Do you think that's changed over time as well? That I mean, I think Collie was saying everyone's got to be able to field now. It's like a sort of.
I'll give you two examples.
No bargaining about it.
Yeah, I'll give you a couple of examples actually. Adil Rashid, definitely they were having some doubts about him because he was a weak link in the field, you know, four or five years ago. And Trevor Bayliss worked really hard with him. And to Rashid's credit, he's totally transformed his fielding ability. And he's good now. He's really good. He's still got a slightly weak throw, but he's much more mobile and reliable and takes some good catches. And the off-spinner from Surrey, Verdi, you know, there was a lot of talk about him going on tour a couple of years ago, maybe even to India. And the word was, he's not a very good fielder. So they'd be more inclined to take, you know, a Liam Dawson or someone like that who could be a bit more multi-purpose. I mean, in a way, that's a shame. And obviously, Monty Panesar was a pretty bad fielder. And so was Tuffers. Although Tuffers actually, he was a bad fielder when he wasn't concentrating. But when he was concentrating, he'd take some incredible catches and do some brilliant stops. So he was a bit of a funny one. But, you know, Monty was became at sometimes a bit of a laughing stock. And I don't know whether, and it's a shame, I don't know whether someone like Monty would be picked now. It depends on the coach, doesn't it? And it depends on how good he is as well. If he's a really good bowler, then he probably still would get picked.
Yeah, I mean, you can probably hide one fielder, can't you? But there, we've all, I mean, it's the old, you know, it's one of the greatest cliches in the cricketing lexicon, isn't it? Catches win matches, and catches, you know, drop catches can lose you matches. Ben Stokes, who we all think of as a very good fielder and a pretty good catcher. I can still see it now, that drop catch off BJ Watling at slip just before lunch at Mount Maunganui. What was it, on the second day, third day? Anyway, I can't remember which day it was, but I remember, I can still see the incident. And Watling was on 31 at the time, and he went on to get a double hundred. And one incident, it made such a massive difference to the outcome of the game. So you can talk about taking five wickets, so you can talk about scoring 100 or 150, but that drop catch cost, I mean, in very obvious terms, cost them, 170 runs, and it cost them a game of cricket.
What about Shane Warne? Bucket hands at first slip, dropping Kevin Peterson at the Oval in the Ashes in 2005. That cost them the Ashes, probably. If he got Peterson out then, I reckon Australia would have won that test and levelled the series and retained the Ashes. So, yeah, I mean, catches do win and lose matches. And I think the one thing about fielding, and I would love to have had a fielding coach like Paul Collingwood, because the one thing about fielding is you can improve by just hard work. And, it is tiring and at times painful because you take the catches in the wrong places. But they now use these Incredibles, which are plastic, sort of springy balls with about the same weight in them as a hard cricket ball, but obviously without the same damaging consequences if you don't catch them right. And just lots of intensive work with that can make a huge difference. And obviously throwing techniques and things as well, and the training required to be able to throw well. All those things, I think, are really fun, actually, to work on. And so, the general level of fielding has improved massively. And, it is quite a fun thing to improve on, I think.
Yeah, well, you're going to do a lot of it if you play cricket. And there's also, I think, as well, I mean, there's also the glory, isn't there? The glory of taking a great catch. I think that, and that's come in, I think, more with, even more now, with, say, T20, those boundary catches that, I mean, they go viral, don't they? There's amazing catches that are taken on the ropes, where, someone leaps up and knocks it back in and someone is there. I mean, it's captivating. It's one of the massive leaps forward for the game, actually, is that brilliant fielding, brilliant boundary catching, and it does. People go, wow, did you see that? I saw Ravi Bishnoi take a brilliant catch in the IPL. It was one of the, sprinting full length, diving, taking the catch. It's one of the all time great catches, and it's actually, in a strange way, it's those things that go around the world virally more than a shot, possibly, or even a wicket or whatever.
So, totally, and I'll give you one little piece of advice. Anybody driving around an urban area, if you see an old mattress being left out, don't ignore it. Give it to your local cricket club, because the way they practice these diving catches over the boundary now is usually with mattresses or mats just the wrong side of the boundary, and then they get hit loads of catches and they dive onto the mattress to try and catch it and flick the ball back or whatever. So, the more old mattresses you can find to donate to your local club to practice those fantastic catches, the better.
Yours, I think it's about time you put your hand in ice.
And maybe go and lie on a mattress, actually, as well, because my body aches. Yeah, don't forget we've got Alan Lamb in the Virtual Cricket Club on Tuesday. That'll be good fun.
Great. Well, thanks very much for listening, everyone. We'll be back with more next week. Goodbye for now.
Podcast Network.